Praise the Lord. Welcome to the Front Runner Podcast. I am your host, Isaiah Marshall. And today we have a front runner joining us, Mr. Ian Humphrey. In this episode, Convicted to Conquer, Ian will share his powerful story of redemption. From losing his mom at an early age, growing up in foster care, committing a crime and being sentenced to 15 years in prison, to now inspiring hope in others. We show you how to run your race to win. This is Front Runner, episode 16. Praise the Lord. Welcome to the Front Runner Podcast. I am your host, Isaiah Marshall. And today we will be speaking to a front runner, speaker, an author, Mr. Ian Humphrey. Ladies and gentlemen, how you doing, sir?
I'm well, my man. I'm just taking a quick picture, you know, so I can share this, if you don't mind. So if you send me the information, I'll post that on my own stuff, and maybe one. I know you're trying to accumulate some content. So once you have it all, let me know.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that, man. I appreciate you joining me, and joining us. And I know that the listeners will be blessed by our discussion for sure. So this front runner concept is one, you know, that I've adopted from my track and field experience. And so the front runner is an overcomer. In track and field, they are seen as the underdog because the odds are against them and they are not expected to win the race. But the front runner is one that takes risk. They bet on themselves. They run their race. They run to win. They lead from the front. And as they say in track and field, they leave it all on the track. And so you, my friend, I see as a front runner. And so one of the things that I want to do, I want to start by tell us a little bit about little Ian Humphrey. So what was your upbringing like? What is your story?
Well, I'll give you I'll give you the condensed version here. But, you know, I think some of my story you already know, but maybe your listeners have never heard, don't know me.
Yes, sir.
So a little bit about me. I was born and raised in South Central Los Angeles, one of the roughest parts of LA, mm-hmm. During the 80s, 70s, and the 80s. If you remember the Rodney King issue, when Reginald Denny pulled off the highway and he was pulled from his truck and beaten, mm-hmm. That intersection is a 2-minute walk from my house.
Wow.
That's where I was born and raised. And I grew up 2 blocks from where the Crips street gang started. Mm. Now, when you talk about the front runner, I entered this world in the back of the pack. Like, the race was already started.
Wow.
I was still, I didn't even know that I was in a race yet. What I mean by that is the odds were stacked against me. I was born 2 months premature. Mm. Literally, my mom was walking up a flight of stairs, 7 months pregnant, and this woman that she had an argument with dumped this pot of boiling water on top of her, sent her tumbling down the stairs and into premature labor. So that's how I came into this world. Literally, when you talk about fighting for your life, that's how I came into this world under these violent, traumatic circumstances. I'm still learning a lot about trauma, but I can tell you this, if you know anything about trauma, it starts in the womb. Mm-hmm. So if your mom is experiencing trauma, it's transferred on to you.
Yeah.
So my mom falls down some stairs, and that's what jump starts me coming into this world before I was ready or should have been here.
Man, yeah.
But my mom, and if you have any questions, just stop me at any time.
I was gonna say that comment you made about trauma, you know, I was just at a meeting yesterday, and one of the individuals said, if you don't transform pain, you end up transmitting it.
Wow.
And it's like, wow. You got to deal with the trauma. You got to process, and you have to deal. The person has to deal with that thing, or else we'll start transmitting that stuff to other people. And it negatively impact our relationships and different things like that, man.
And I'll add to that, man. I know I can tell you what you're saying is true because I've done it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a short part of my story. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. But that's kind of what led me into prison. But the fight to overcome trauma, it's a day-to-day thing.
Yes,
depending on how depending on how severe the trauma was. But I can tell you, every day when I get up, it's like, okay, I'm gonna make sure that I don't transfer this on to somebody else, you know. I gotta recognize it, and I gotta do something to combat it. So it is a real deal.
That's a good word, man.
So, but you know, my mom, so she ended up with third degree burns to over 25% of her body. And as a kid, I can remember sitting on her lap, and you could see the third degree burns from her neck all the way down. You know, I know that it covered her chest area and her stomach area and part of her lower waist. But so, as you can imagine, she was in a lot of pain. So imagine, if you know, for the women watching this, imagine being a newborn mom who gives birth during after this trauma. And something that I've learned over the years, Isaiah, is the strongest connection known to man, and even I think even in the animal kingdom, is the connection between a mother and her child.
Yeah.
But at least for adults, that connection, it's nurtured over the first 3 years of life. I imagine, you know, it's created while the mom is holding the baby, talking to the child, nursing the child, just loving the child. But for me, because of where those burns were located on my mom, she couldn't nurse me, she couldn't hold me, so I never really, I didn't get that connection with my mom. And not only that, because of the pain or because of those burns, she had to take heavy pain sedatives. So while she was on that medication, she couldn't watch me because the sedative would just kind of put her out. So I bounced around a lot. You know, I didn't stay in one house, so that you have the, so I had the instability of not having a stable home the first 3 years of my life. I'd stay with my mom, my grandma, my neighbors. I did that for the first 3 years of my life, which is difficult.
I know in your bio, you mentioned how that you succumbed to the negative voices that had always always told you that you'll be just like your father growing up. And I know, you know, I have similar experiences as well. My father was in my life, but had a very distant relationship. But it was always this notion like that I would be absent like my dad was, because that's how, you know, my dad was and a lot of the other men in my life or around me were. And just those voices that would tell me, hey, you will be just like your dad. And also growing up, often hearing that I was more likely to go to jail than to go to college, you know, just wanting to be accepted by, you know, men around me. And always having this feeling to perform, to be accepted. To perform the plea so that I could be accepted by others. And I'm wondering, like, as you heard those things growing up, like, how hard was it hearing those voices for you?
Well, I got to tell you, you know, when I say I succumbed to it, my father, my entire childhood, he was in and out of prison, and that's where he died. My mom passed when I was 12 years old, and that had a negative effect on my life. After that happened, I just start wilding out. So I start hanging out with the wrong people, breaking in houses, I was stealing cars. And so people would tell me, you are going to be just like your father. Meaning I was going to go to prison. So like you said, it's hard to hear that. But not only that, I grew up in a neighborhood where more people did go to prison in college. I grew up attending more parties for people coming home out of prison than I did for people graduating college.
Wow.
So it's sending this message to me as a child, like almost as if maybe prison is a passage to manhood, you know, because as a kid, you see people being celebrated. Who doesn't want to be celebrated?
Right.
But I was learning it from the wrong place. Wow. So I did end up walking, following in my dad's footsteps. I did end up committing a crime and spending almost 5 years, 5 years in prison. But what I'll tell you where things stopped for me is things got real. You know, nothing gets your attention quicker than a judge saying, hey, the state of California sentences you to 15 years in prison. Wow. Nothing gets your attention more than hearing a prison door, that lock, engage, and you cannot get out.
Yeah.
Now, so I say it got my attention, like, okay, this is real.
Yeah.
For me, I realized over a course of time that prison, I didn't like prison. You know, most people, that should be what most people say. But yes. When I said I didn't like it, I made the decision at some point. I said, I'm not dying in this place. Wow. It took some time, but I said, I'm not going to die in this place. Life has so much more. I have so much more to give. This is not how my story is going to end. And I'm writing the story. So I said, if I can get out of here, I'm never coming back.
Wow.
I said, if I can get out of here, I'm blessed enough to become a father. I'm doing everything different.
Yeah,
I've been able to do that.
Now take us to that courtroom. I know you said there's no feeling that kind of gets your attention than hearing that judge say that. Like, what was that feeling for you? Like when you heard the judge say that, like what feeling came upon you?
It's like, you know, it's coming, but you hoping it's not. Like you hoping that for some reason that they say not guilty, even though one, you know, you're guilty and you know there ain't no chance in hell that they're going to find you not guilty. So before they tell you what you know is going to happen, you're hoping it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And then it actually happens. There's a level of certain denial that comes over you. There's a certain level of fear that comes over you. There's a certain level of, there's a large level of what if, or what's next? What's next for me? You know, can I go through this process? Can I go into the prison system, and can I make the changes that I need to change, get out, and live a successful life? So there's all of this stuff that all of this emotion, like you know that you're not going to see your family again. You know that their life is going to continue while yours is paused forever, for however long you are behind those barbed wire fences. So there's just all this emotion, thoughts, and fear, man, like that I've never experienced before.
Man, so did that change instantly happen when you were sent off to prison? Like, how was that?
No, it didn't. You know, when I first got to prison, something else happens. And this is what happens to oftentimes with the number of people that end up in the prison system. For me, I can remember standing in this prison cell after those doors locked and my knees started shaking. I collapsed and then I just fell to the floor on this concrete floor and I cried. Once that emotion passed, then I entered into a why me phase. Then I entered into a this is not my fault phase. I said, this is not even my fault. This is my father's fault for not being there. This is I was in and out of foster homes as a kid where I was abused mentally, physically, and sexually. So I said, this is not my fault. I would not be here had my foster mom not abused me. I would not be here had my father been present. So I went through the blame game.
Wow.
So I went through the why me phase. So when we talk about recidivism and people that get out of prison and come back, it's important to me that people understand it's hard to get out of prison, whether it's physically or mentally, if you remain in the why me phase, if you remain in the blame phase. I had to come to a point where I had to look myself in the mirror and say, hey, this is your fault. You committed this crime. This is not your daddy's fault. This is not your foster mom's fault. This is your fault because you did what you did.
Yeah.
So put the burden and the blame on your back and carry that weight and do something about it. It's wow. only when we can do that, that you can make the changes that you need to make.
Yeah. So accepting responsibility.
Yes.
Like fully yeah. accepting responsibility.
Got to fully accept it. Fully accept it. No, no part of what I did was anyone else's fault. Yeah. What happened to me was tragic. Yeah. It should never have happened. That does not give us or anyone else an excuse, as you said, to take that pain, to take that trauma out on somebody else.
Yeah.
Nothing gives us the right to do that. We've got to seek the help. We got to seek the help that we need to get yeah. better. And if we make some mistakes along the way, we got to own them. We got to own them.
Wow. So you went through this that phase where you just broke down. And then you went through a phase where you was just denying. And then the blame phase. So when did you get to that point where you was like, you know what, I got to do something about it? And like, how did that like process of doing something about it or righting your wrongs and redeeming, you know, what you did wrong? How did that process look like?
Well, I want to share something with you. When I was in court, when I was in court before I was sentenced, they have what's called where the victim can make an impact statement.
Okay.
So the victim can, the victim or their family, they can get on the stand and they can address the person that victimized them.
Yeah.
The man who I assaulted, I almost killed a man. His daughter got on the stand and she was about 9 years old.
Wow.
I'm going to tell you, man, I was 19. I didn't have the kind of courage that this young girl has. She got up on the witness stand and she says to me, she says, "You took my Superman away from me."
Mm.
Now, Isaiah, I didn't kill him.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, when she said that, "You took my Superman away from me," that hurt me in my heart. And yeah. still to this day, I can feel that. I can feel it because you understand this. I didn't have a father growing up. The one thing that I always wanted was somebody I could look up to and say, "This is my Superman."
Wow.
You feel me?
Yeah.
I took
that
away from her. I knocked her father off of that pedestal that she held him on. I didn't have the right to do that.
Yeah.
So sitting in that courtroom, shackled up, I made a silent promise to myself. I said, if I can change my life, I said, I'm gonna do something to make this right for this little girl.
Wow.
But the change didn't come right away. My first year in prison, I spent a lot of time in solitary confinement playing a blame game. But kind of, I guess the short story is there was a lot of pieces that came together for me.
Yeah.
There were volunteers that came in that prison that taught me lessons. Like, for instance, they taught me lessons like when volunteers were coming into the prison, they didn't have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And my first, because when you experience trauma, you have issues, trust issues.
Yeah.
So when the volunteers were coming into the prison trying to help me, I'm like, "What do you want from me?"
Mm.
Because you're not coming in here and you're not wanting something from me. Nobody does that. And I tried to push them away. They kept coming. What that taught me is, you know what? People can give. It's okay. People can give and not expect anything in return. And wow. It's okay for me to accept that. And I don't owe them anything. And they don't expect anything in return. So that was part of the lesson. Other part of it is there was an educator, and I talk about him in almost every speech that I give.
Yeah.
His name was Charles Lyles. This dude worked in that prison.
Mm-hmm.
This dude, man, he refused to allow me to feel sorry for myself. And he didn't feel sorry for me. So one thing that I talk to people about, I say, hey, don't allow anybody, no matter what you've been through in your life, don't allow anybody to feel sorry for you. And don't surround yourself with people that feel sorry for you, because then you stay locked into that phase of feeling sorry for yourself. So if people are holding you accountable and they say, hey, stop feeling sorry for yourself, then it forces you to face certain issues that feeling sorry for yourself, you don't have to face them. So this teacher, man, every time he saw me, he would say something positive to me. "What's up, Mr. Humphrey?" Like he would say something positive to me, and he would speak life into me, even though it was the worst moment of my life.
Yeah.
He didn't see me for the mistakes that I made. He saw me for the man that he knew I had the potential to become.
Man, that's deep. That's deep.
So he poured that into me. And finally, I said, hey, if this man believes in me, he believes that I can get out of prison and change my life. I said, I'm going to do it. And at first, I can tell you, I wanted to do it for him. But then there's something that happens over time. What you realize is any change that we make in our lives, you know this. Your audience, I know you guys know this. We can't do it for anybody else.
Yeah.
We got to do it for ourselves.
Yes, sir.
And always in the back of my mind, I held on to that young girl's words. You took my Superman away, and I held on to the silent promise that I got to make changes. I've got to get out of prison, and I've got to kind of, I guess, make right, return what I took from that young lady.
Man, that's deep. And I know, you know, in hearing that, especially like the influence of the guy, I think you said his name is Charles, and how he saw you as the potential that you could have become or that you were going to become. And I know for me, again, you know, track and field experience and growing up in that context, so sports was sort of an outlet for me. And I had my track coach in high school was one of the people I say often that had the most influence in my life, because it was something similar where he saw something in me that I did not see in myself.
Wow.
And it's like, but as you said, you have to take ownership of that. I could not compete. I couldn't do it for him. No. I had to see what he saw, and I had to work for it. You know what I mean? There's work that goes into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just appreciate, you know, you sharing about the influence that someone else had. And I think it highlights the importance of us just recognizing those people in our lives that kind of help us get to where we are today.
Absolutely. Because we don't get where we are. I owe everything I have and almost everything that I have become to someone else helping me. Now, at the end of the day, like you said, someone's belief in us doesn't get us to the finish line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, it helps us, but we got to still do the work. Without the work, we don't cross that finish line.
So it seemed like there was a process for you, and you were able to bring redemption. I mean, to right some of your wrongs. So I'm a spoken word artist, and one of the things that I use the platform of poetry to do is, as I say, I like to create art from broken pieces. So in other words, it's like, man, you take something that is rough and ugly and messy, but you try to create something beautiful from that. And it sounds like out of your messiness and the challenges that you had to overcome, and you've created something beautiful, and you use now your story to share with others, to uplift it, to motivate and to inspire them. So what inspired you to use your story to do that for others, to inspire others?
Well, it goes back to that promise that I made to that little girl, man. I got out of prison because here's the bottom line. I got out of prison in 1997. And then I had to do a certain amount of years on parole.
Mm-hmm.
I completed my parole. Once I completed my parole, I didn't owe anybody anything. I didn't owe the state anything. I did my time. I completed my time on parole. I don't owe anybody anything.
Freedom.
I have my freedom.
Yeah.
But that silent promise that I made to that little girl is my own self-imposed, it's my own self-imposed sentence. I have to continue to try to right that wrong.
Yeah.
So that's really what I try to do. When I'm going out and giving a presentation, I'm going out and giving a speech, that young lady who's no doubt is a woman now, probably has children of her own. She doesn't even know this, but she is my inspiration. When I see kids, my own kids, they're my inspiration. Like, I have so many things now that breathe life, that give me life. All of those things, it gives me inspiration. I'm going to share something with you, because as a speaker, as an inspirational speaker, You know this. We have our bad days. Every day is not a rah-rah-rah day. Some days I have days when I'm dragging a little bit.
Yeah.
But I got to focus on, you know, I got to channel my own inspiration, my family, my friends, other people's success stories.
Yes, sir.
Right? So yes, I've got to channel those. And every day, that's my daily inspiration. So every day when I get up, so when I get to my office, the men get here at 7 o'clock. I get here about 5:30, like way before the first worker is supposed to be here.
Yeah.
People, they often say, why you get here so early? Well, because I got a process I got to go through. I got to get my mind right. I got to get ready for the day mentally. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm watching motivational stuff. I'm reading. I'm touching base just kind of with my inner self so that I can start the day, I guess, on the right foot.
Man. Yes, sir. That's a good word. Now, I know your book and your mantra is not about the knockdown. So what's one or two lessons that you could give to the listeners about just that story? Just encouraging them.
When I talk about, you know, that's my main signature presentation. It's not about the knockdown. It's about the get up, right?
Yes, sir.
I was saying, if you spend your life focusing on what knocked you down, you will miss the blessing that has been sent to pick you back up again, right? So here are a few things that I use that I had to come to understanding that were necessary for me to get back up.
Yes, sir.
Because life is going to knock you down. There's no doubt about it. It's not if, it's when.
Yeah.
So a few things that I would say. One is make no excuses. Don't make any excuses. Own whatever you need to own that put you down.
Yes, sir.
Own it. Second thing is take some chances. We gotta take some chances. I moved here to Colorado from LA. I only knew one person. I had never been to Colorado, had never seen snow before, didn't have a winter coat, I wasn't ready. So I moved out here, I bought a one-way plane ticket and a winter coat, and that's all I bought.
Yeah.
I was taking a chance.
Yeah, you took the risk.
I took the risk. So you got to take certain chances. You got to always surround yourself. You got to be careful who you surround yourself with, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another one. Is you got to reach further, meaning you got to do more. I think Zig Ziglar said this once. He said, you got to do more than what people pay you for.
Mm-hmm.
That was necessary for me to rise. Every day I do more than what people ask me to do. And then the last one is refuse to give up. Because once you rise, once you get knocked down and you rise, guess what? There's somebody else coming. I tell people, life only throws uppercuts, haymakers, and low blows, right? Ain't no fair fight. So the knockdown is going to come again.
Yeah.
So you got to refuse to quit. You got to refuse to quit. So those are a few strategies or a few things that I say every day, and I talk about those in my book that are necessary, man, for you to rise like yeast.
Hey, man, that's powerful. I mean, I remember a quote from the movie Red Tails. It said, you know, life could be a cruel teacher. First she gives you the exam, then teaches you the lesson.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, but you know, these lessons that you just communicated to us, like, you know, make no excuses. You know what I mean? And take some chances. Be careful who you surround yourself. That's very important. The Bible says that, you know, bad communication can corrupt good morals, and it says do more and refuse to give up. So you've overcome, like you talked about how you were an underdog, that you were born into this world behind the pack, and you had to overcome your circumstances as a kid. You had to overcome being in prison, and now, you know, you get to share your story and inspire and motivate others all throughout the country. And so you're using your platform to edify and to speak life into other people, and you're doing some really good work. I appreciate that.
No doubt. Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, this, it, it, you know, I, I'm going to keep on doing this for as long as, you know, as long as I can.
Yes, sir.
You know, I feel like it's necessary that once we make it through difficult times, it's important that we reach back, grab somebody's hand, you know, and pull them and try to pull them through it. Because we talked about this earlier. I didn't get through this alone. I had some help. So yes, I am obligated to reach back and help someone else.
Yeah.
Because what happens is when I reach back or when we reach back and we help somebody else, here's what we're doing. I talked about that young lady that took that stand. What I hope I have done at some point is prevented someone else from being victimized or using their trauma and victimizing someone else.
Mm.
So that's important for me to share my story and make sure that people know, no matter what you've been through, no matter how many times life has knocked you down, as long as you are willing to get back up, life will get better.
Yeah.
As long as you put in work, life will get better.
Yes, sir.
You know, if we don't stay in this place unless we allow ourselves to.
Wow. That's a good word, man. I appreciate you sharing that. So how do you keep yourself from falling into the comparison trap? In other words, how do you stay focused on running your race?
Well, here's one thing I would say, I believe this wholeheartedly, is there's enough lanes on this track for all of us.
Yes, sir.
All of us. It's very easy. When I first started speaking, almost 13 years ago, it was very easy to watch somebody else and try to, let me do what they do.
Yeah.
You see somebody else, let me do what they do.
Yeah.
Let me do what this person doing. But what's successful for one person may not be successful to you.
Yeah.
And if you are running somebody else's race, you are not living up to your full purpose and your full potential.
Yes, sir. So
you can't run somebody else's race and live the life that you were sent here to live.
Yeah.
And there's enough lanes on this track for all of us. So I have conversations with speakers every day. I get more engagements than I want to take, Isaiah. I give those to other people.
Wow.
Right?
Yes, sir.
So if someone asked me once, they said, well, aren't you afraid that they're going to take your customer? No. Why? Because there's enough lanes for all of us. I can't hold all this in. I can't keep all this to myself. It's selfish, right?
Yeah.
Selfish. And I believe that we have to pour into other people and we have to give.
Yeah.
Because once we start to give, it all comes around full. It all comes around full circle.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't compare myself. I don't fall into the comparison trap because I believe that there's enough room out here for everybody, and I've got to be true. I got to be true to myself.
Man, that's powerful. And we recognize that we were beneficiaries of others pouring into us and influencing us and adding value to us. And it's like, how dare us not do the same?
You know, absolutely.
We know the benefits of it. And so we want to impart that into other people as well. That's a good word. Now we're going to move into some, you know, what I call rapid fire questions. But it's not always rapid, but we'll move into this section where I ask you some questions. You just kind of answer off, you know, however you feel led. When challenges arise in your life, who or where do you look to sustain you and help you get through?
I have to say, first and foremost, I look to my wife.
Mm.
I look to my wife. My wife, man, she believed in me when all I had to my name was potential. You hear me?
Wow.
I didn't have nothing to my name.
Yeah.
So I've had to lean on her, and I've had to learn to, because of the trauma that I've gone through, I've had to learn to be able to trust people. But first person I go to, I would have to say, is my wife.
That's awesome, man. Now, what are two things you appreciate about yourself?
Man, I appreciate my resiliency.
Yes, sir.
I gotta appreciate that. And the second thing I would have to say is, in spite of a lot of things that I've gone through, I have to appreciate the sense of humor that I've been able to maintain and and at least look back and find on some of the things that I've been through in my life.
Now we hit on this, you know, a little bit, but how important are friendships and being in community to you?
Oh, wow. man, community. I'm going to talk about this in the presentation that I have coming up on Tuesday, Canada. Community, man, without community, and here's what we mean when we say community. I'm not talking about where you live.
Yeah,
not about where you live. Oftentimes people think about, well, it's my hood or it's where I live. My community is the individuals that you choose to surround yourself with. So it doesn't matter where I'm at, my community is still with me. I can call them up on my phone. Reach out to them. So so my community is like the dream team, or it's like your support. It's like my support system. I have people in my phone that I can call if I need help, that I can call and talk to, that I can lean on.
Yeah.
Because the misconception is that we always have to be strong, right? Nah. My community. When I'm not strong or when I feel weak and I need somebody to carry me, we gotta lean on our community. So
that's good.
That's the importance of my community.
Yeah. There's a verse in Ecclesiastes that said, you know, a three-strand cord is not easily broken. And it's like we lean on those, on our support system, on our community when we feel weak and we feel broken, and when we're experiencing life challenges, because they could be a source of joy in the midst of it. It could be a source of encouragement in the midst of it as well. And so, yeah, that's good. That's important, man. So what is bringing you joy right now?
Oh, man, my family. First, my family brings me a tremendous amount of joy. I got my son here working. He's in high school. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm about to be a grandfather.
That's so awesome, man.
So experiencing things in my life that I know a lot of people didn't have the opportunity to experience. Like, I'm blessed to get up every day, take a deep breath, and say it's a great day to be alive.
Yes, sir.
I think back on my life, Isaiah, and it's like, you know what? I'm not supposed to be here, man. I'm not supposed to be here. So every day, it's like I get to see my, you know, every day before I leave my house, I give my wife a kiss. I give her a hug. Anytime I talk to my kids on the phone, listen to me when I tell you this. I talk to my kids on the phone. I don't care if I talk to them 5, 10, 15 times every day. I end that conversation with, hey, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
I love you. That brings me joy.
Yes,
but it also tells them, if this is the last thing that I say to you, you're going to know that I care about you and that you mean the world to me.
Wow.
So just these simple things bring me joy every day, but it starts right at home. I don't have to look no further than the individuals in my house, or my four children, my wife, and now this grandbaby that's on the way. So,
yes, sir.
So I'm blessed, man. That just life every day, just breathing, you know, I find something to find joy in, just very simple things.
That's awesome, man. Now, what does winning look like and what does it mean to you?
Oh, winning. That's a good question. That's a good question. Winning for me at the end of the day, I feel like I take my role as a provider very seriously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I take my role as a husband very seriously. I take my role as a father very, very seriously. So for me, winning to me is, what legacy am I going to leave when I'm gone?
Mm.
That's winning. So I've raised four beautiful children. They're all successful. They don't necessarily depend on me. They are doing great things. They are pouring back into their community. That's part of my legacy. When I'm giving these presentations and I'm speaking, or I pick up the phone to mentor someone, or you know, I'm texting someone to say, hey, how are you doing? Because I know you went through some tough times, right?
Yes, sir.
That's my legacy. That's my footprint. So it's what's the footprint that I'm going to leave when I'm gone?
Mm.
Because like my grandmother still lives on through me. I'm part of her legacy. Right.
Yes,
then I'm passing that on to my kids and then my own individual personality and my own convictions. So I would say winning to me is what legacy will I leave? What positive changes will I have left on this world when I'm gone?
Man.
That's winning, man. That's winning.
Powerful. That's a good word, man. I appreciate that. Well, Ian, I appreciate the discussion. Very insightful information, and just hearing your story, man, it's so encouraging and inspiring. And it just shows us that, man, we're not victims. Oh. You know what I mean? We're not victims. You know, we take ownership of our mess ups, our struggles, but man, we have to do something about it. And we have to put in the work to do it. And I think your story just shows and highlights what it looks like when we put in work from, you know, in redeeming ourselves or righting our own wrongs. No doubt. And I appreciate that. Now, how can the listeners follow you?
If they want to follow me, they can, you know, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm on a few of those things. I'm not super active, but you can find me there. You can just, mm-hmm. you know, Google, look up my name, Ian Humphrey. Go to my website, ianhumphreyspeaks.com. Mm-hmm. You can reach me there. Find out more about kind of, I guess, what I do. And that's what I would say. Just go to my website, ianhumphreyspeaks.com, and let's connect.
Yeah. So, and they can purchase your book there too as well, right?
Purchase my book there. Yep. Oftentimes, man, I send out a lot of free copies of my book. You know, I make myself available to people that are struggling. So if anyone's watching this video and you think, hey, you know what, I need to reach out to you, go to my website. Find my email address. Mm-hmm. Send me an email. And we can have a conversation, or we can have a discussion, or even a conversation through email. But I would start ianhumphreyspeaks.com.
Awesome. Well, Ian, thank you so much for being on the Front Runner Podcast. I appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, my man. It's always a pleasure, and it's been too long. If I get back out to Tennessee, I gotta remember. I gotta find you.
Come through. All right. Well, blessings to you.
All right. Thank you.
Follow the Front Runner Podcast and share with a friend. Also, follow me on Instagram at @TheIsaiahMarshall. Subscribe to my YouTube channel, which can be found in the show notes. And while you are at it, be sure to check out all of my released spoken word poetry projects anywhere you stream music. Thank you for supporting my creative journey. This is the Front Runner Podcast. Until next time, bless you. I leave it on the track.